What we have dubbed reachability analysis, that requires a little bit of explanation, so we'll get to that. So a little bit about me. My name is Daniel Heimering. I'm a software engineer at Isovalent, which is now part of Cisco. I am a Cilium committer. Cilium is sort of what we're the focus of the topic today. I'm a maintainer of the eBPF Go library, so our Cilium/eBPF, if you're more familiar with that. And I also maintain the eBPF docs for anyone who's seen that before. So I'm standing here on the podium, but I would also like to acknowledge my colleagues of mine, Timo and Robin. Timo has co-authored a lot of the work that I will be presenting here today. He's also a co-maintainer of the Cilium eBPF project. And Robin, who I don't think directly worked on this, but he did review everything and gave us great feedback and stuff like that, so I wanted to acknowledge him as well. So let's get in. So we have been on a sort of journey to modernize Cilium. Cilium is now 10 years old, actually one of the first users of eBPF ever. So there's a lot of history there, and there's also a lot of technical debt. So one of those interesting things is that if you would write any project, eBPF project today, or most of you, would probably compile ahead of time, ship your programs as an ELF on your target, and then just run with that and use the nice little the nice core facilities to make sure that it works everywhere. However, 10 years ago, all of that didn't exist. So back then, we decided to just ship all of Clang and all of our source code always to target, modify that slightly for whatever we needed, and then run it. And we don't want to do that anymore because we don't have to anymore. But we have the technical debt, so there's a few reasons for doing that. If you don't have to compile, it's faster. Compilation is really slow. If we don't ship Clang, we have smaller images. We get a lot of CVE reports on like parts of our images, which we don't use. They're like standard libraries that we had to import because we also have Clang. If we can just get rid of all of that, we have lost a lot less security related things. And hopefully, if you don't have a whole compiler in the loop at runtime, we're hopefully going to have less bugs. But this has been going since 2003. I found the issue that Timo created back then, and we're still working on this. But we're getting really far, quite close now. So the key in making this happen is load time configuration. So we can't do things at compile time anymore. We need to shift everything that happened at compile time to happening at load time. Cilium is really complex, and it has a bunch of settings, options, a lot of optional features. In fact, I counted them. At the moment, we're like halfway through this conversion, but we have 94 different settings. They're being booleans, numbers, IP addresses, that sort of thing. That all need to that all go into the data path. At load time or compile time before that, but again, we're migrating from that. We used to do this with preprocessor macros, so we would conditionally compile out bits of the code that we weren't using, and then the compiler would take care of all of that. But now we compile everything in. Now you need to, at load time, disable or enable that. And the two patch series that really made this happen for us are linked here. So actually the verifier can do dead code elimination. So what it does is if you provided a variable and it knows that this variable is always certain, like static, you have a branch, like an if statement, and it says, okay, hey, this branch is always taken or never taken. It can it realizes one bit is dead code, completely removes it. At least if you're running as a privileged user. Otherwise, it just patches it out with knobs and jumps over it. The other thing that makes this happen is tracking of the read-only maps. So if you have a global variable, like so you get sort of the code that I have here. So if you have a global variable that gets put in a in a map, in a BPF map. That's how global variables work in BPF. If there's read-only, so a constant, and you freeze it when you load it, the verifier says, hey, that the content of that map is static. I'll just treat it as a scalar value, as a number, and then it flows, and then it works. So you can write code like this, where you say, I have to make it volatile, because otherwise the compiler gets smart on me. But if you declare it like this, you have a volatile const, I can change this constant value from user space, and I can actually enable or disable code in my BPF program that will be completely removed from the jetted output. I'll show that example. So this is what we used to do. So the question now is, okay, cool, I can like control bits of my code, but how do I do this with maps? One of the core values of Cilium is that if you disable a feature, you don't pay for it. You don't pay for the CPU, you don't pay for the memory, you don't pay for BPF data path complexity. So if I'm close to a complexity limit, for example, which used to be the case more, nowadays it's less of an issue, but if that's the case, then I can disable a big feature and I can enable more smaller features. That's the idea. So the user chooses what they want to run, and we just make that happen in the smallest case. Which also means that if I have feature A, which uses a map, how do I now make sure in this new world that I do not have this map loaded and there? So this is what we had. And then you say, okay, we know the solution. Let's do the naive fix. We create this global variable, the constant. We wrap our usage code. And then, sure, we have to like provide the map initially. But surely after that, that map is freed, because the only place that uses it is gone. So we know if the program that uses a map gets unloaded, it also removes your map. But unfortunately, that's not the case actually. So don't be scared. This is like eBPF disassembly, but it looks like almost like C. So I'm gonna help you through it. The things I wanted to look at have the red line under it. So the first thing that happens is we check our enable flag. So we load the read-only map. We load the Boolean from that. It gets checked. And that's like, in this case, we have it set to true, so the body of the function still exists here. And then the body, we have the second map, which is the one we wanted to get rid of if we don't use it. And then in the output, if we inspect which maps are associated with which programs, we can see both maps are associated. Expected, that's normal. So let's now disable this feature. So disable my feature, we still have the read-only map. We don't have the map anymore that I wanted to get rid of, but it's still associated. What gives? So turns out that it is a quirk of the way the verifier works at the moment. This is slightly technical. You can download the slides later and follow the nice links. And essentially what happens is in the verifier, you load your program, and there's this function called resolve pseudo load imm64, which is a little bit verbose. But every time you pass file descriptors for maps into the kernel, it converts these into the actual pointers to the map, because at the end, kernel needs to work with the actual map as it is in the kernel. It does a flat scan. It adds all of it maintains this list of the used maps, which is what you see when you dump the program listing, and it increments the ref count. We make sure that this map stays loaded in the kernel while we are still using it. Then the majority of all verification happens, like all of the complex things that we love and hate. And then at the very end, once we have like done all of the other interesting things, there's this optimization pass, which is where the dead code elimination that I talked about earlier. It happens in three stages. So first it detects the branching thing and it like hardwires it to normal jumps. And it puts like no ops in between, and then it will actually gradually in steps like remove the no ops and make it so that it's completely gone from the jetted output. But the interesting part is that we never, if we remove the last usage of this map, we never released a ref count, we never removed this from the used maps. So it means that even if I, after that code elimination, my map is still associated, it still holds on to the memory, even though it can never use it. So that is just the state of things at the moment, and I'm sure that can be improved. So we have to work around this. So the first workaround that we thought of was to do a double load. So we would load our program once, but instead of loading like maps that allocate like megabytes of space, we would just set them all to max entries of one. So we still need to create the maps, but it's not that bad. We load our program, and then we can read it back and see, hey, we see that exactly these maps were eliminated, and now we can reload the program with the actual maps that we're going to use minus what we determined is unused. And then for the places where we had the original unused maps, we patch out the file descriptor. So if the funny thing, even if you can't just set the file descriptor to zero, it always has to be like valid, but you can basically tell the load instruction that it's not loading a file descriptor but just a scalar number. So that's what we do, we make it a scalar number, recognizable hex code, so that if we ever see it in a in an error message, then we know, okay, this is probably due to some bug in our logic. And then after this we load again, and this works. Like, actually works decently, except for the cases where it doesn't. So one problem with this is it takes really long. Cilium has really big programs. We have 50 tail calls altogether. Not all of them are always there, but we have big programs, big tail calls. It can take like a significant, like 200, 300 milliseconds to load big programs. So that's really undesirable. It takes a lot of CPU, a lot of memory, etc. We have to still create all of these maps. And also there is a limit in the kernel where you can only use like 64 maps at max. I think Cilium currently has 80 something maps defined. I would have to look it up again. But we have a lot of maps. And of course we don't use them all at the same time, which is why we want this. But if we still have to like initially load with all of them at the same time, there's a chance we are going to run over this limit at some point. So we want to avoid that. If I have to load a map that might not be supported on the current kernel, like the arena map, this doesn't work because I have to initially load it still, create it to be able to do it the first time. And the last thing, which we actually discovered later on after we decided to switch off of this workaround already, is that if you have a combination of sysctl enabled, it actually prevents you entirely from reading back loaded instructions, the jitted instructions, and even the xlated instructions. And if that's the case, this approach just wouldn't work. So if you're on a very secure system, this just wouldn't have been possible. So we thought, okay, second workaround, slightly like maybe even simpler, or like in principle it's simpler. You just match whatever you do in C and go in your user space. So if you say in C, I only use this map if these features are enabled, then I match that in my user space. But now you have two places, they need to keep in sync. If you've ever done this, you know it's very difficult to maintain. We have a lot of maintainers, a lot of people that might not know about this. There's a lot of chances for this to go wrong. And if we make a mistake, our programs just will not load, will not run, will not do anything. So we decided this is just not what we want long term. And thus, we landed on reachability analysis. So the idea of reachability analysis is, what if we knew which instructions were reachable before we had even loaded them into the kernel? So this is essentially recreating a very, very small version, a bit of the verifier, specifically for these load time configurations. We adopt this reachability analysis, and this is actually applicable not only to maps, which is like the main use case I'm presenting, but also for tail calls with hard-coded slots, and BPF to BPF functions, specifically global BPF to BPF functions, where if I know I don't have to, like, if I don't use them, I might be able to just completely avoid loading them in the kernel the first time, reduce a lot of time loading programs into the kernel that I never end up using. Same for maps, the same for global BPF programs. And it actually addressed most of the concerns we had with the other approaches, so we don't have to load maps ahead of time, we don't have to do a bunch of things. The only thing is it costs engineering effort, because now we have to do these interesting things in user space beforehand. So what? How does this work? How does reachability analysis work? So first, we need to break up our code. So I took the code of this example program. We need to break this up into basic blocks. And a basic block is a block of code, sequential instructions, that are guaranteed to run together. So the way you do this is we first go over the code and we identify all of the branching instructions that we have here. And we say, okay, that's the end of a block. So we start with one big list. That's the end of a block. And now we identify all of the points where we jump to. And every time you jump to it, then it means that these instructions might not execute always together. So that's the start of a block. And this was our block list. So we get this list of blocks, they execute, and now we can make assertions about these. And if we visualize this, you get something like this. So we have this, we have our entry block, it can jump all the way to exit, it can do these other things. You might have seen this if you are into reverse engineering or into compilers or that sort of thing. And I've added a little bit of annotation here. So when we do this, we maintain some metadata. We say, okay, we have a branching block, a fallback block, and we have a list of our parent blocks. The bit I left out of this is BPF functions, because it didn't fit on the slide, frankly. But we also maintain a list of if we ever do a function call to a BPF to BPF function, it's not branching, because it will always return. We maintain that just so we can always discover. So if a basic block is reachable, then we also say, okay, that BPF to BPF function is now also reachable, and we can recurse through that. So that's not here, but it does exist in the actual code. So we've done all of this. We have our block list. Now what? So now we need to discover where our load time configuration is. And if you go look at the instructions, this is what if you have these like volatile consts, then this is what it looks like. So you load the pointer to the map, this read-only map. So it's all of your constant values live in the same map, in the same array value. So it's an array map with only one entry, and it's a really long thing. And it actually they take the ELF read-only data section and just put it in the map. So we have this map, we take an offset, so we need to know the same map, and in blue we have the offset. Here it's the only variable, but you can imagine that if you have a lot of them, then every variable has its own offset. It gets loaded into this green register, and then that green register is compared. In this example, it's an equals operation to an IMM value. So it's a value that is encoded in the instruction itself. And this is essentially the easy example that we look for. We know that this is a branching instruction, so it must live at the end of a block. So when we go and do this, we can just loop over all of our blocks. We see is the last block a branching instruction, and then we backtrace from that. So we go look and see if we can find a case where we find these instructions. And of course, you can't be clobbered. So if we loop and we find that between these two instructions, R1 gets repurposed for something else, and of course, we haven't found it. So we're looking for this very positive, for this very positive pattern of, okay, we need exactly this. But there are some variations. Now, once you've done this, you can actually, because we know which variables we're going to load with, because we already have the map value essentially prepared, we can just predict the outcome of this branching instruction. So we can say, okay, either this always branches or this never branches, And then that has implications for our blocks, because if we now know that we can remove like the green or the red arrow, now we suddenly know that, hey, these blocks are unreachable, or they might be. So we don't need to implement the whole verifier, but we only need to implement this slight bit of it. And of course, it's not as easy as just looking for these three instructions adjacent to each other. So one of the things that can happen is a verifier or a compiler gets smart on you, and they're like, okay, so we're gonna first load this variable that we're gonna compare with, and then we're gonna insert a bunch of other random instructions, including another branching instruction, and only then are we gonna use it. So now we need to deal with this. What we've done is we looked at like specifically Cilium and what happened, what occurred. And what we found it in like essentially all the cases that we were able to find, there's usually only one ancestor, like only one parent of the basic block where this happens in. So we don't only just backtrack in the local basic block, but we can also say, okay, if there's only one exactly one parent, we can just treat it as if that was also a basic block, because you can only get into this block if you go via this other one. So we implement this, and that can actually follow over multiple, and it again asserts that this register doesn't get clobbered. You have other interesting cases. So if you have a signed, in this case I made a signed 16-bit integer, and if the compiler decides to use a 64-bit comparison instruction, Now you need two 64-bit numbers, but you have a 16-bit number, which you always load as unsigned. If you were to just put this in here, it wouldn't work. Registers are 64 bits. The CPU thinks that even if I load only 16 bits into it, it will still treat it as a 64-bit number. So compilers do this clever thing where they shift the number up, and then use a signed shift down, so it preserves the sign, and now you basically cast your 16-bit signed number into a 64-bit signed number. But we have to like account for the fact that this register might change, and also we need to track how the actual map value evolves so that it matches, so that we accurately can predict if this works. And on newer CPU instructions, so the ISA V3, there's variations of this where it uses 32-bit numbers instead, because we got the instructions to do this. So there's a bunch of logic here. Same goes for unsigned numbers. It can be that it's masked off, so you actually need to implement these like masking operations as well, and even masking and shifting if it was, for example, a bit field or something like this. And then the last one, I made a mistake on this slide. Bonus points for anyone who spots it. But the last interesting case that I'm going to handle. Oh no, the second one is if you have two 64-bit numbers and you want to compare them, the compiler actually does this. So it uses a register compare and puts a constant in the second register. The reason for this is that this IMM value that was encoded in the comparison instruction is only 32-bit. So if you need to do 64-bit constants, it does this other pattern. So you need to keep track of how this. So we needed to keep track of this pattern as well. And in the very last edge case, which unfortunately we had to do some actual macro stuff for in our code, is this. Sometimes the compiler gets even more clever and it says, okay, you use this variable, like you check for this feature flag like 16 times. Perhaps we should store this in a stack. But this makes it really difficult to like find this pattern without implementing a whole verifier. So if it does this, where it like it saves it into some register and then it reads it back like 40 basic blocks later, that's really annoying, and we decided to just not handle this case. And the workaround that we found is if you change the way you write the code slightly, we can trick the compiler. So what we say to the compiler is in this ASM block. We say, okay, we always want to dereference, so we always get this value. We always want to dereference it, just always emit this right before the branching instruction. So we essentially force it to co-locate the branching instruction and the dereferencing instruction. This one, we put these together, and then I believe almost guaranteed it will also put this R1 instruction next to it. So it isn't perfect, but it improves the reliability of this enormously. And that sort of brings me to final conclusions. So reachability analysis, this whole concept, seems like a good tool for optimization, because it reduces a lot of it reduces load time and memory usage during loading, a bunch of these other things. Although I would really also like to see the verifier get improved. It would be really cool if the verifier could, like, if we could teach the verifier to just release these maps if they get that code eliminated. But even if that were the case in the future, there would likely still be a place for this logic just for the tail calls and the BPF functions. It should be noted that the system errs on the side of caution, so we always keep maps unless we can absolutely prove that they are dead. So the system has false negatives but doesn't have false positives. And I wanted to basically put this question to the audience as well. It's like, is this a very Cilium specific use case? Like, we ran into this, but do other people maybe see a use for this code? Would this be something other people are interested in? And something I just throw away thought, perhaps, of like, could we make this work with signing, or does doing this user space stuff like make true signing in some ways difficult or impossible? So interesting things to, maybe we'll do a talk about that whenever I figure out the answer to that. Then before I go to the questions, I realized I completely forgot to put the link to all of this code in the slide, which is sort of sad. But I do have it. So if you, it lives in the Cilium repository at the moment. So under package BPF analyze, you can just look at it, see what this does. I believe you can even, if you wanted to, copy just this code, use it elsewhere, or import it. For now, you would need to import like the whole of Cilium, which is a bit excessive. But like, you can already play with this today. Perhaps if this does end up being useful, we might just split this out into some separate repository or something. And that brings me to questions. If we still have, I don't know how much time we exactly have left. But,
maybe one.
Maybe one. Okay. Yeah, we have one hand going up.
Hi, very interesting presentation, thank you. I was wondering if it's possible, instead of doing this analysis in user space, to somehow probe the verifier to get the information that you need about the reachability of certain blocks out. So then you just let the verifier do the heavy lifting and take the info. It brings back the double loading problem, of course, but maybe you don't have to implement such complicated analysis in user space.
Yeah. So technically you can just fix this with if the verifier were to like release the map ref count, then you could just load your you still have two big maps. But you load them, you have like a peak of memory usage, and then they just get released afterwards. So it's like it's not as nice as this, but it would be a way to avoid a lot of the user space work. I think that would be a good way forward, at least for the maps, the map side of it. Yeah. Right, I'll go make room for the next speaker.
Anyone that has already started to work on proving the verifier regarding the map ref count?
I haven't started working on this, but I really look forward to seeing if I can get a kernel patch upstream for this.
All right. Thank you, Dylan.